Today's talk has been by Dr. Lauren Bierman of the Centre for Environment, Fisheries and Aquaculture Science, CFAS. Her talk is entitled Building Bridges to Satellites, How the UK Government is Encouraging Uptake of Remotely Sensed Data. Dr. Bierman completed a master's degree in biological oceanography at the University of Cape Town, and a PhD in biogeochemical oceanography at the University of St Andrews. And also worked from 2012 to 2016, I think, at the Sea Mammal Research Unit. So I must ask you about the nocturnal habits of seals. I was trying to photograph some seals in the harbour the other night, and I put the laptop to bed. So I don't quite know why I found myself there freezing, taking photographs of seals. I'll need to ask you about that. And since September 2015, Lauren has also, of course, led and contributed to a number of interdisciplinary projects within CFAS. But her main role is leading the marine portfolio for the UK's Earth Observation Centre of Excellence. As principal investigator of the Marine Earth Observations Applications Platforms, she coordinates engagement with the DEFRA Marine and Fisheries Evidence Team to facilitate the adoption of remote sensing in current marine monitoring strategies. So, we therefore couldn't be in better hands, seal lovers or not, for what should be a very interesting seminar on all things EU and marine. So, over to Lauren. Thanks.
I think that's the nicest introduction I've ever had. You make me sound like a lot cooler than I am. Thank you, everyone. This is a full house. This is amazing. Thanks, everyone, for showing up. As Owen said, I'm... I am the senior satellite scientist at CFAS, which is a really cool title, but what it actually means basically is that within my three roles, the one that I do at CFAS is I'm just really a glorified data scientist. But I do have other roles. I actually prefer this one the most because I get to do really cool applied projects, but I'll talk a little bit more about them. The thing that I'm going to sort of focus on a little bit around is the building of bridges to satellite data, which I do as the marine lead on the DEFRA Earth Observation Centre of Excellence. And then I recently received an email from this group who was setting up UKGEOS, which is a cross-government Earth Observation Service, and they said to me, we'd really like you to stand as marine liaison on our group. And I sort of said, I'm really honoured, that's amazing, I'm really busy though and I'm afraid I can't take on the role. So of course about a week later I got an email saying, welcome and congratulations, being marine liaison on our group. So, and then it's not about UKGEOS, and basically they will decide. But actually, I should thank them because they're starting to kick off some really cool projects, which I'll talk to you a little bit about. But basically, I thought it might be worth, I don't really know my audience, so I'm going to do a very brief run through of what Earth Observation Science is, what is satellite science. This is a remote sensor, if it worked, this would be a remote sensor. So what do I talk about when I talk about remote sensing? I'm specifically talking about remote sensing from low Earth orbits, where satellites detect electromagnetic radiation reflected from Earth. It's, in a nutshell, all information on objects or areas that's from a distance. And I use it interchangeably, which is probably quite naughty, but Earth observation, remote sensing, satellite science, I'm going to use them interchangeably. They're one and the same. For all three of my roles and all of the work that I do, I use a range of remote sensing data. There's a little asterisk next to all to remind myself to tell you that that's a blatant lie. This is just a fraction of the Earth observation satellites that are out there. These are just the NASA satellites. And I do tend to use all of these. I use data from all of these satellites. But I've highlighted ESA, the European Space Agency, here because it's actually, as much as I grew up on NASA data. This is the data that I use for my PhD, and it's data that I still use today. But it's the ESA data that's been a paradigm shift within government. It's the ESA data that has allowed government to reach a stage where they're confident in starting to integrate remote sensing into the policy work that they're doing. So, as much as there's a lot of data out there, not all of it is always relevant in terms of spatial and temporal coverage for work that government needs to do, which is quite specific delivery of objectives. The other thing that I'm going to be quite specific about is the fact that I, as much as I'm the only remote sensing scientist at CFAS, I still feel like I'm part of a team, and that's because if you've ever worked with remote sensing data, you'll know that in-situ data is absolutely vital if you want to trust the products that are collected in space, especially if you work in UK waters, which are really optically complex. I think there's 14 or 15 different types of water classifications just around the UK, really complicated waters. And so before I start extolling the virtues of how amazing satellite data are, it's really important to say, but there are limitations. Satellites only measure the surface of whatever it is you're looking at. And that's particularly true in marine. Obviously, there's a lot of vertical complexity. Some of the most interesting stuff happens at 400 meters or 4,000 meters, but satellites only measure the scale. If you're looking at ocean color, a type of Earth observation from passive sensors, they can't see through cloud. They can't even see through smoke or fog or dust. And that's a bit of a problem if you're trying to look at forest fires and you can't even see what's underneath. There's also reduced accuracy in complex waters, which tend to be the more interesting ones, like the coastal areas. I worked in the high latitudes, really, really cloudy, really, really complex waters. I didn't do myself any favors. But the benefits are that satellites can revisit the same spot on Earth every single day or every few days. There are improved algorithms that are enhancing the accuracy in complex waters, and cloud is always going to be an issue, but we have radar that sees through clouds, we have LiDAR that sees through clouds, and spatial resolution is improving. So to illustrate that point, I thought I'd put this up. Does anyone know what this is? Have they seen it before? If you've seen it before, don't cheat. Don't pretend that you know what this is like it's new. You have to guess. No one? Okay, this is the Black Sea in summer. This is an algae bloom, as seen from Sentinel-2, which is a terrestrial satellite. And if we zoom in a little bit on this beautiful sort of eddy in the middle, that over there is a So that's the kind of spatial resolution that we're seeing, and it's the spatial resolution I never thought I would see in my lifetime, where I was used to looking at 4 kilometer resolution pixels, and I'm now able to detect the wake of a single vessel moving through an algae, the eye of an algae storm. So it's pretty phenomenal stuff that I get to work with in my job now. The other thing about satellite data, as much as it has these problems, is that if you want to understand something that's happening in your bay, whether you're an aquaculture farmer or you're measuring water quality, you need to understand whether perhaps your water quality is being affected by something that's happening upstream. Is it agricultural runoff? Is it runoff from a city? Is it just a localized impact? Or is it perhaps something that's being washed inshore? Is it caused by a climate mode? Is it caused by El Nino? Is it caused by climate change? So all of these spatial scales, whether it's regional and local, all of the way to global, the thing that ties it all together, it doesn't matter what you're looking at, there is a single thing that you can use to tie it all together on different scales, and this is satellite data. At CFAS, I think CFAS is perhaps better known for the really cutting-edge lab work that they do, high-throughput sequencing, DNA analysis work in the aquaculture quite extensively. We do a lot of in-situ work. We're on the ground collecting really valuable information. This is our boat, the CFAS Endeavour. We're out under all types of conditions trying to collect really valuable in-situ data and keep some really good time series data going. And we have some really good model stuff. But again, the thing that's tying it all together is the remote sensing. And I'll talk to you a little bit more about this, because even from the sequencing, we can take it through to satellite data and tie it all together. And I've got a nice little sort of anecdote. One of the guys who works on the CFAS Endeavour came to me. He just put in a smart buoy. So these are these great buoys that CFAS have that are out throughout the year, and they collect data. And one of the things that they try to do is to track the initiation of the bloom of the phytoplankton bloom every year. This is a good illustration of what 4 kilometer resolution data look like. If you compare that to that single image that I showed you with the boat and the wake, it's a step change. It really is a step change in resolution. But he said, you know, for 3 years in a row, the smart boys told me that there's been no initiation of the phytoplankton bloom, and I don't know what's going on, like what's happening to the environment. And I said, okay, well, what I'll do is I'll go back in time, take a look at where your smart boy is, and see what's been happening in the waters around your boy. And basically what I said to him was, buddy, your boy's in the wrong place. Like, the bloom's actually been getting stronger every year. You just need to move it 2 degrees to the east. So this is, again, where that spatial resolution, being able to take a step back and look at what your in-situ data is doing, is actually quite valuable. So again, that's all just anecdotal, a bit of background. I'm going to talk to you now a little bit about the work that I do as a satellite scientist at CBAS, talk to you a bit more about the DEFRA work that I do, and then right at the end, talk to you about some UKGI stuff. Okay, so this is the the highlight of my career. Doesn't matter what happens in future, I came up with Finding Nemo. Okay, so I'm tracking Northeast Atlantic mackerel with Earth observation data. And this is a project that I really love because it kind of ties a whole bunch of stuff together. So I'm going to get really excited and try and calm myself down. So I came up with this project a while ago, and this might be relevant because I actually heard people talking about Brexit while I was sort of drinking beer in the corner. This project was picked up by the Brexit team, and they wanted this data to be delivered to them within a ridiculous amount of time, but it's okay. They're interested in the mackerel because if you go back in time, and I'm from South Africa, I don't really understand this, but before there were the mackerel wars, and now there are no mackerel wars, and that's good, but there might be mackerel wars again, so we have to be careful. So one of the things that they're really interested in is making sure that we have very good up-to-date information on the mackerel distribution because it's changed substantially in the past few years. Mackerel used to kind of be quite far south, and now they're being caught all of the way in Russia and in Iceland. So, Norway and the UK were basically the two countries that used to have a bilateral agreement on managing the stock, and now it's a lot more complicated. So, the CFAS have been collecting mackerel distribution data since 2007. The way they do this is through acoustic surveys. Mackerel don't have swim bladders, so they're able to sort of chug along and take acoustic measurements, and they can look at all of the fish, but they know mackerel are mackerel because they have a very distinct signature in the acoustic range. So we have this really nice data set of in-situ mackerel distribution data. This does go all of the way to 2017. It's just with the Brexit work, they said you've got 2 weeks to give us some results, and so we didn't have time to reanalyze the whole data set. So I'm just giving you the initial results that we worked on. And we wanted to look at whether the distribution of these mackerel were related to things that we can measure from space, like sea surface temperature data, chlorophyll A, the depth of the euphotic zone, and the mean sea level height anomalies. And what we found was that, in fact, sea surface temperature was a really good predictor of where mackerel were going to be, as was bathymetry, which is obviously kind of a satellite-derived product, but it is something that we looked at. So where you have high temperatures, you're not really going to have mackerel, but you are going to find them where you have cold temperatures. Where you have high chlorophyll, you're not going to find mackerel. They seem to prefer clear waters. This might just be because in the North Sea, they're not spawning, they're foraging. It's a bit simplistic, but they're visual predators, and they are also, you know, part of the base of the food web, so they need to be made sure that they can see what's coming. And in terms of bathymetry, they really don't like shallow waters. So this was, you know, just a neat little project that we looked at, and we found some really nice results. So then we said, cool, there you go, Brexit team. Like, we didn't sleep for 2 weeks. There's data. And they said, great, this is fascinating. This is stuff we didn't know. Can you go do that in the Northeast Atlantic now, please? And we were like, cool, so give us the in-situ data. And they were like, there isn't any. So what were we going to do? We couldn't just say, well, the sea surface temperature is here. We don't even know if the population's behaving the same way. On one side, they're spawning. On the other side, they're foraging. How do we create an in-situ data set? Satellite data. So what I did during my PhD is I was looking at tagged southern elephant seals in the Southern Ocean, and I was trying to, from their speed and from their tracks, determine when they were traveling and when they were foraging. And I thought, well, aren't mackerel boats just the same things? They're just tagged top predators because they have communication networks aboard the boats, and I can pick that up from satellites. So what if I use that network to figure out when they're foraging and when they're traveling? And when they're foraging, I know that mackerel have to be there because they've got obviously really sophisticated instrumentation on board. If they're stopping to drop their nets and trawl for 3 hours, it's because they've seen huge schools of mackerel. So, literally based on a really simple algorithm that I developed during my PhD, I treated fishing boats like seals. And I used something called automatic identification systems data that all UK and EU vessels have to carry. And I looked at all of their tracks over the winter fishing period, over all of the time that AIS data was collected. We bought this from a third-party commercial operator. And wherever they slowed down enough, I knew that mackerel had to be present. So we found hotspots of mackerel. And because we had data as well in the North Sea, I was able to compare that data to where the acoustic data said that there were mackerel, and the overlap was really, really convincing. So I had confidence in my method. And that was the only way I could really validate the data. It's really messy along the coastline, obviously, but we found a really nice way to fix that. It's just like I said, I was showing you the initial results, which I'm putting to the other one. So based on this hotspot data, I said, okay, well, is it the same thing? And yet again, a really strong relationship with cold sea surface temperatures. This one showed a strong correlation with sea surface height anomalies, and the bathymetry, again, was a really strong indicator. So there again, we used a bunch of sea surface remotely sensed data to look at something as applied as where do we expect to find mackerel, and can we look back in time, because the satellite record is 20 years long, can we look back in time and start to see perhaps why they're moving north? Are they expanding their range, or are they actually shifting north? So this was a really nice project where I got to be a satellite scientist investigating where mackerel go, which is a really nice application of data. So that's the kind of stuff I get to do at CFAS. It's really fun. It's really nice applied science. That's very different to what I do as the marine lead on the DECRA Earth Observation Centre of Excellence. My job there is specifically to convince the UK government to use satellite data in their monitoring. About 2 years ago when I started at CFAS, I went to a conference that the MMO were hosting, and the head of the then head of the DEFRA Marine Evidence Team stood up in front of everyone and she said, there's not a single part of policy that I can think of that would benefit from the integration of satellite data. And I thought, okay, at least I know where I'm starting from. But things have changed enormously in the last 2 years, and now DEFRA are very, very engaged with including Earth observation data in their policy and in their monitoring. And they recognize that they're a government institution and that perhaps they're not the most savvy when it comes to big data. So for example, this is actually quite a famous story within DEFRA. The chief scientific advisor to DEFRA wanted to download a single Sentinel-2 image. So basically, like I showed you, that old bull storm, he wanted to download an image like that. Just a single Sentinel-2 image. And it far surpassed the data download limits of what DEFRA allows. So he couldn't download one image of Sentinel-2 imagery, of Sentinel-2 data. So there's a recognition that there are some problems. But DEFRA knows that they want to become more savvy. So this is where the Centre of Excellence came in. This is why it was started, is to help DEFRA become a better customer of Earth observation data and to make them world leaders in utilizing that sort of data, especially under tightening budgets, recognizing that you might not be able to send out the CFAS Endeavour 3 times a year or 3 times a month, but if you still want to be able to measure the things in the water, perhaps the best way to do that is from satellite. The vision of the Earth Observation Centre of Excellence is to create a portal for that reason, to basically deliver that sort of Earth observation data that DEFRA themselves haven't been that good at downloading. But what it means to me is make satellite data easy to use. And when I say easy to use, I also mean fun to use, because it really is a lot of fun to work with this sort of data. I realise that some of the barriers are taking really simple problems. Really, really simple. Satellite data are really big. I understand that. Not everyone plays around with MATLAB at 3 in the morning thinking, this is so cool, and that's okay. You can still be very good at your job without needing to use MATLAB and cloud processing if you want to just integrate this into a report, and I respect that. And so the best thing to do is to make the data accessible. There was also a lack of information on that vast range of existing satellite products. Remember I showed you that animation of all of the satellites. I think initially the head of DEFRA, when she said that she couldn't think of a single area where satellite data would help, she knew of one satellite product, and it was eutrophication. That's not even really a product, it's chlorophyll. And there's sea surface temperature, the sea surface height anomalies, there's so much that you can measure from satellites. And it's just a lack of awareness, and we can't expect people in government to have this information at their fingertips. So it's about being aware of those barriers and then building bridges to overcome those barriers. So I had a workshop a few years ago where I got governments in the room with academia, and we had a conversation about products that already exist, products that are in development, and products that are possible with a bit of funding. And more importantly, what does government need in order to do their jobs more effectively under dwindling budget situations? And the things that people ask for are really simple things. These are very much within the realm of possibility. then wanted to know which sea surface temperature maps to use. I had a guy talking about the fact that he was publishing a paper on tracking Vibrio around the EU coastline and the European coastline, and he didn't know what sea surface temperature product to use, but he was using one and it was sometimes reliable and it sometimes wasn't. I was like, this is so easy, I can definitely help you with this. In fact, I can deliver the information to you in GeoSat. You don't even have to work with me for next year. Chlorophyll A for the eutrophication set. But also high resolution crop maps. The UK is an island. The stuff that goes into our golf courses and to our fields, it gets washed into the coastal zone. Is that why we're seeing a higher incidences of red tides and harmful algal blooms? This isn't the sort of thing that government needs to know. Those are the three things that took me 5 minutes to put on a portal. Not as high resolution data, but as GeoTIFF, that anyone who works with any form of GIS platform can just integrate immediately with no problems. These over here, these are the things I'm going to talk to you a little bit about. Because these are the projects I'm working on currently for DEFRA in order to provide those products. And those are the things I have to think about a little bit ahead in the future because it's just one person. But also, I sort of understand where they're going to come from, and I feel like in a year's time, it's going to be a lot of the problems will be solved. So the timing feels pretty good to leave those until the next calendar year. So I'm working with Cranfield University to deliver this product over here, the AIS and radar maps. The reason that's relevant is because we don't really have a really good idea of the pressures, the water pressures, the spatial pressures around our coastline. So we can easily build some maps using radar data and AIS. We can take a whole bunch of free radar data, satellite radar data from Sentinel-1. It's a European Space Agency satellite. It's the first satellite to give us radar data for free. The resolution isn't as good as commercial imagery, but it's still brilliant. You can detect individual vessels at 10 meter resolution, so that's pretty extraordinary. If you take those individual snapshots and overlay them, you can find static things, so you know where your wind farms are and all of your installations. But if you put all of them and you overlay the snapshots, you start to get an understanding of where your pressures are. So if you're potentially prospecting the areas to put in an aquaculture farm, don't put it here. I don't know what this boat is doing or why there's high intensity here, but you don't want to put your aquaculture farm there. The shipping lanes are pretty standard, but the rest of the activity is kind of unknown. And as much as you have AIS data, it's so much more real to get this because the spatial scale is deformed. So this is exactly what it looks like in UK waters. So if you put it together and you start to, for example, look at the channel, and you start to overlay all of these images in space and time, the UK has got really busy waters. And now you can see where everything is. So if you have a marine protected area, and you have activity in that area, it's not necessarily that you're trying to catch Joe on his fishing boat. It's that someone might be there recreationally, not doing any fishing, but they put down an anchor. And that anchor drag is in a really sensitive area with a benthic environment that you're trying to protect. If you want to understand pressures, you need to know where boats go. You're not trying to catch people doing something illegal here. You're just trying to see what patterns you can pick out. And I'm very into patterns. So this is just from radar data. What we're doing with this radar data is we're combining it with that AIS data I told you about, how we use to track the fishing vessels. And we're using that so that we can automate the detection of vessels and try and do some investigatory identification work as well, so that we can, with a degree of confidence, say this is a fishing vessel or this is not a fishing vessel, which is kind of important. So we use AI for a bunch of stuff, but we're mainly using it for validation of this project, because the phase two is to take it to the overseas territories, and that's where the UK's main marine protected areas lie. They're vast, they're really hard to police, and they're really vulnerable. And there's a lot of unregulated fishing that happens here, and we can't see it because there's no AIS out here. So how do you see where people are going? How do you see what they're doing? Kerguelen is one of the only places that has Sentinel-1 coverage because the rest of the islands are too small for the European Space Agency to have recognized that those areas might need coverage. So we're in touch with the European Space Agency, and we've requested Sentinel-1, which is the radar, and Sentinel-2, which is a high-resolution terrestrial satellite, to get coverage so that we can start to do some of the policing and monitoring work on behalf of the British Overseas Territories, where there's one police vessel and they don't know where to send it, and they've got hundreds of thousands of kilometers to monitor. So that's something that we'd really like to get involved in. This is an example of high resolution Sentinel-2 imagery. The reason we'd like to get this sort of data is because we don't have AIS, but we still need a way of validating that it's not a wave, it's a vessel. But you can detect vessels in these images, and so we can potentially do some of the validation data with the Sentinel-2 imagery instead. The alternative is buying really, really expensive commercial data. I mean, the commercial data is flipping amazing, that's great, and you can get it every 4 hours instead of every 2 days, but it's completely unaffordable. And I personally think that the free data is going to catch up in terms of resolution and coverage. So we're doing it on commercial data and free data, just so that the method works, even if you're buying the data or getting it for free. But I have a feeling that in a few years' time, when I hopefully give a presentation again here, because you guys have great there, that I'm going to say this is what the new free data looks like. So I think European Space Agency is just doing the most extraordinary stuff. Right, the second thing I'm going to talk to you about is number five, it's the water clarity stuff. We're working in conjunction with Plymouth Marine Labs. We're going to be the first group in the world to deliver a product from Sentinel-3. Sentinel-3 is the dedicated marine European Space Agency satellite. The resolution is coarser because you don't need 10 to 30 meter resolution over the oceans. But we are getting 300 meter resolution products of suspended particulate materials around the UK coastline. This is close to my heart because if you're looking at seal behavior around the Scottish coastline, one of the things that might be affecting these visual predators is the fact that the water is becoming more turbid. The other thing that is interesting is that the whole of the North Sea is becoming more turbid, thanks to human activities like dredging, but also increased storminess from climate change. And what is the impact going to be, and how do we get a measure of that? You cannot monitor SPM of the whole of the North Sea unless you're using a product like this. So it's not just the coastline that's interesting in this case. Right, UKGEOS. It's a really hilarious job. They sat me down and they said, right, so by the end of the calendar year, we'd like you to deliver a cool project, something that's, you know, something that we can talk about in the lift. And I was like, that's in 3 months. And they were like, exactly, so off you go. And so I had to come up with something that wasn't just about DEFRA. It had to be cross-departmental. It had to be relevant to many departments within government. And the thing that I came up with is this little thing that I've been thinking about for a long time, because like I said, CFAS are really quite well known for a lot of the lab work that they do, and they do some really cool stuff in aquaculture. And I want in on the aquaculture, because aquaculture is cool. And I think we could do it better. Wouldn't it be amazing if CFAS helped aquaculture become more sustainable and more environmentally friendly? That would be amazing. Last year, for the first time, farmed fish surpassed wild fish consumption. So we now produce more fish than we catch from the ocean. And that's not just because we've overfished, that is true, but we're actually actively trying to reduce our footprint on the oceans, on the wild poor fish. But at the same time, the more we farm, the more we realize that we're having an impact, whether it's through disease or pests. So we should be able to fix that, but because we're having to move so quickly to keep up with demand, we're not always doing the best job, and I feel like this is something that we should really be working a bit harder on. UKGEOS. So obviously I can do things like look at sea surface temperature data. A lot of the diseases that affect aquaculture industries and wild caught fish are really closely affiliated to sea surface temperature. But I have this really cool high resolution satellite data, why wouldn't I use it? And the thing is, again, we're an island, the stuff that we put on land washes into the ocean. And, okay, how many people in this room knew that fish get cancer? Seriously, I have no idea, that's like a lot of people. So flatfish get cancer of the liver, and one of the things is that CFAS has been monitoring this, and to date, it's been really hard to tie how they get cancer. And one of the things is it's likely to be exposure to chemicals or heavy metals when they're very, very young, and their nurseries happen to be in the coastal zone. So one of the things that we'd like to do for UKGEOS, and just as part of this kind of work, is to look at nursery exposure to things that are washed out in the river plumes, and we can see the river plumes, we can see where they're going, we can classify the types of water, and say, okay, we think this load has probably got a very high metal content, where it's got high agricultural content because we know that there's a pig farm up above, or we know that there's a high-intensity rapeseed farm, whatever, we can start to classify the waters and predict what's being washed into the marine zone, if it's associated with the sediment or not, and if it is, where is that sediment going? Does it happen to be in a flat ocean? That's also really relevant for aquaculture. There's this mussel farm, there's a mussel farm somewhere, and they were like, we'll get really far from the plume, we'll get really far from the coastline, we'll do it in the middle of this bay, because the water will be cleaner, except that the plume literally just goes straight through their farm. So, you know, if you want to plan your aquaculture farm, just make sure it's away from a plume if you think that it's got that side. That's generic enough. So that's really important for some of the work that CTAS again are doing with Plymouth Marine Lab to try and support the aquaculture industry to make sure that whatever we do it sustainably. CTAS are actually a really great institution to work for in that they're a lot more progressive than I thought they would be. They recognize that we perhaps need a new generation of scientists. They don't just say multidisciplinary is good. They need multidisciplinary scientists. They need people who can talk to decision makers and take complicated scientific things and just turn it into English. And they're also aware of the fact that sea literacy is not going to work if you just have sea literacy within the sciences. You need to have sea literacy throughout, and that includes the decision makers. And they're also one of the only agencies I've ever worked for who include people in their thinking. So it's not just that they care about environment, of course they do, they're massively, we are massively involved in the environmental stuff, and of course animal health is a big part of that, but it's also a case of we recognize that our coastlines are good for our mental health, and we want to be able to look at the ocean and recognize that there's life beneath it, and to derive some enjoyment from that, to think, there's a seal foraging over there, and this makes me want to stand outside at 3 a.m. with a camera. But to recognize that we are intrinsically linked to whatever benefits come from the ocean. And we are also increasingly migrating to our coastlines, which is great for us, but it also exposes us to greater risk because of climate change, increased storminess. And if we don't look after our coastlines, then CFAS is not going to really have a job for the next 20 years. We want to go ahead and protect our environment so that we have something to keep working on for the next 20 years. We're working really closely with government. I mean, we are a government agency, but we're working really closely with other departments to make sure that we have the same, like we're working in parallel. We try very hard to do this thing where you create data once and use it multiple times. We're trying to stop this reinvention of the wheel where three different departments are doing similar things in three different ways. And we just waste resource and we waste people's time and we just don't do things very efficiently. And the future of the seas is very tied to the fact that we need to work more collaboratively with academia. And, you know, you guys are hopefully going to be the next generation of people working at CFAS. And we just like to continue to sort of involve all sectors of things for the benefit of the marine environment. And but if you have any questions, then I guess we have lots of time to talk about it. So, thank you. If you are too shy to ask me any questions, this is my email address, please feel free. But also, UMetSat have got this amazing resource. If you guys are interested in getting a general overview, and I didn't do a good job of it today, they do these massive online open courses. And you can go and learn about all types of ocean color, all types of remote sensing, not just of the marine environments. I've been doing like a Landsat course through them. It's absolutely brilliant. So this is an amazing resource. If you want to learn more in your own time, UMetSat are a great resource. That's everything.
Thank you very much. Questions? All right, straight in there.
I've got two questions actually, if I can repeat you.
Yes.
The first is your tracking of the vessels in the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
How did you distinguish that the fishermen were fishing for mackerel and other species?
Okay. we have MMSI numbers, which is the unique identification number of each vessel. Well, actually, that's not true. We have that now, but again, because we had very little time, what we did was we went map the fishing vessels of this size, and we also happened to be quite lucky in that it's only the winter fishing season, and so there's much less likelihood of it being blue whiting. If they're out there, they're out there for mackerel, and they're the right size, and they're displaying this type of behavior, so there must be mackerel fishing boats that are going for mackerel. What we have now, which is slightly more robust, is the actual identification numbers of the vessels, and we were really lucky because it's all matching up. So that's a very good question, but I'm annoyed that you asked.
My question was using remote sensor data to track vessels, particularly like really contested areas.
Yeah.
Is that being used for policing at the moment? And also, I'm guessing, but I may be wrong, you don't have the resolution to be able to say, well, we know whose boat that is.
Correct.
You can get an understanding of how much of a problem it is.
This is it. So remote sensing data is probably not the best way to police your oceans. It's a really good way of detecting patterns of misbehavior, though. So the resolution, even on the commercial satellites, is not good enough to say, there's Joe on his boat doing something illegal. And when they talk, if anyone ever says to you, real time, with satellites, they're lying. It's near real time. And with the Sentinel data, it's not even really near real time. With the commercial stuff, you can get information from 4 hours ago. That boat is long gone. But if you know that it revisits this one quadrant of your MPA, then you know at least to send a patrol vessel there. That's where you're vulnerable.
Is that being used at the moment?
No, because the marine protected areas that we're looking at don't have coverage at the moment. So Sentinel-1, the radar satellite, is already operating at near full capacity. So the European Space Agency are already pushing the sensors to try and get us this data, but it's really important because this is a no-brainer, right? Like, of course you want to use this data to see what people are doing, but it's difficult, so we're trying to roll that out. It's something I'm very passionate about. Yeah.
Camera, thank you.
Hi. Very old, so please forgive this question. But some 30-odd years ago, we had a workshop in the offices of the much-lamented Nature Conservancy Council, where guys from the, I think it was the UK Space Agency, told us that satellite imagery was going to be the big thing, was going to be the answer to all of our prayers, and every government department would be using it on a daily basis.
Sorry, how 30 years?
You explained about specialist, not quite academic, but specialist scientific type applications.
Yeah.
Would you say that 30-year-old hype has been fulfilled? Or if I suspect it hasn't been,
The thing is, so again, I started working at DEFRA and I went through the one day and the guy said to me, you are the answer to our prayers. You're going to get rid of our need for in-situ monitoring. Entirely satellite data is going to fix everything. And I said, no. If you want to trust the satellite data, you need to put more smart boys in the water, please. Satellite data is great. And it can, if you integrate it into the work we're currently doing, then it's brilliant. 30 years ago, the resolution of the data was rubbish. I mean, it's great that we have a time series, and if you're working in the marine environment, that having 20 years of any data on those spatial scales is brilliant. But satellite data is only now becoming extremely valuable, and that's why DEFRA is only now starting to take it up, because the resolution matches their requirements. I cannot imagine that 30 years ago, 4 kilometer resolution data was going to mean anything for meeting requirements. Will it in the future answer all of the problems? Absolutely not. Will it be a key puzzle piece of the work that we're trying to do? Yes, absolutely. But holistically, satellite data has got its place, and it does have its limitations, and that will continue to be true. Yeah.
So you mentioned thinking about how different departments being able to share more data. But is that kind of being coupled with a move towards the use of more open source software?
Yes.
So it becomes easier to share between departments, industry, academia, and the general public?
Absolutely. So everything that I do, that portal that's being developed, the AI is processing software. Everything I do is like a public service, and it will be entirely public-facing. So all of the things that we're doing now are for sharing. There's no more of this cards to my chest. It doesn't. It's not going to get us anywhere. And that's why I like working within the Center of Excellence, because initially I think there was a lot of competition between the agencies. They didn't like to share, and now we have this sort of center, and everything that we do is not just shared between departments and agencies, but it's public-facing.
Well, does this extend into part of your processing and analyzing data? So it's not
Absolutely.
Just giving kind of finalized
comments? No, all of the code that goes into anything that we do, all of my code, all of the code from Cranfield, all of the AIS processing code, all of that is available. Yeah, definitely. No more black boxes. It's rubbish. It doesn't get us anywhere. Yeah.
Hi. Thank you for your talk. It was really interesting. So I'm an administration master student. I used to work very loosely with the Agriculture Stewardship Council.
Oh, amazing.
So I have a couple of questions about applications and types of working agriculture.
Yeah.
So one of them is, can you monitor effluents from agriculture farms using rings?
So in the coastal zone, it's unless there's like a real big colour differential and there's an optical property to it, it's very, very hard to do. Actually, the way that I see the aquaculture stuff working is more inland, where it's more land use change that's affecting water quality rather than the runoff that's affecting the marine environment. But that's not to say that the technology won't catch up. So it's easy to map a river plume, right? It's so dramatic. It's this blue ocean and this brown water being washed out, especially after a storm event. After Irma in Florida, the plume extended 3 kilometers, and it was so dark. It was the most beautiful, terrible thing. And it's really easy to see something at those scales. But if you literally want to see like a 10-meter plume, and it's sort of the same color as your muddy sort of coastal waters, it's really challenging. That's not to say it won't eventually be done, but yes. There's some, I'm working with this guy in Egypt, and 30% of aquaculture is unregulated or illegal. And he can't get onto the farms because he'll get shot. But I said to him, hey, like, do you want to take a look? Let's sit on my computer and I can show you what it looks like. And the effluent there is so green that even just with the without even correcting for the atmosphere stuff, it's so clear and you can see that effluent. But that's an extreme situation. Sort of operationally, it's going to be more challenging. Okay,
yeah. It's to do with the impacts of agriculture on wildfish stocks.
Yes.
Are there any applications where you can monitor the movement of wildfish stocks in the river?
Yeah.
And try to avoid overlap in the agriculture areas?
Yes, so there's a lot of stuff with telemetry that's really important. So you have little listening devices and then you have tagfish. This mackerel stuff, it's one of the first times CFAS has investigated trying to track movements of wild fish populations. But I think in terms of going for stuff that isn't rigorously fished, then the sort of telemetry stuff is still going to have a really important space in finding out where they go and making sure that there's very little overlap. So Norway obviously has a lot of money and they do really, really well with their salmon farming. And they've been trying to think of really out-the-box ideas how to have salmon farming that has... First of all, they just get decimated by sea lice. They're getting a lot of flack because they're infecting the wild populations. And they were actually looking at taking old barges, like huge vessels, and filling the ballast tanks with salmon and doing the salmon farming on the ballast, like in the ballast sort of areas of the ships, so that there would be less of an impact and that there would be less crossover. I don't think that went anywhere, but people are trying their best to think of ways to minimize that crossover and the impact. But it's so new. This kind of food security from aquaculture is a really new field, and it's growing so fast, and I feel like we need to catch up. But it's, you know, this is where you can get a bit creative with the science, which is quite exciting. Yeah.
I guess it relates a little bit to the question before about the sediment films, but I realise you put a disclaimer at the beginning of the talk that satellites are only seeing the surface
yeah.
of the ocean. But I understand that there are ways which you can kind of model or integrate with
Absolutely.
Data to learn about stuff going on deeper.
Yeah.
I mean, the example I think now looking at that is that that's not a map of ocean proper, that's just the surface.
That is
Most
the surface.
Of it is at the proper maximum.
Well,
so are there, I mean, are there ways or is CPAS developing ways where you can start to look at deeper in the water column for lots of the different things that you're doing? So not just chlorophyll, but also the sediment, because there's a sediment plume at the surface, but there'll be a sediment plume
absolutely
on the bottom that might be going somewhere else.
So the benthic guys don't really like me because I don't really talk about them at all in my talks, but we are doing a lot of benthic ecology stuff and we're trying to get as much of the vertical water column as we can. I mean, my PhD, I had fluorescent sensors on seals and light sensors on seals in order to try and map as much of the vertical water column as possible. It's really hard. Being able to see the surface is kind of easy. Chlorophyll are kind of good in that way, or phytoplankton are kind of good in that way, because if they are at the surface, you can see them, and if they are at a maximum and there's nothing below them, above them, then your optical depth will change where they are. So satellites measure the surface, but they are able to see to at least an optical depth, and that can sometimes in the gyres be really, really deep. In order to really get the vertical complexity, though, it's in situ. And of course, we're doing a lot of that. There is proposals for getting a LIDAR, a really, really intense laser in the green spectrum on a satellite. I'm all for this, by the way, to measure the deep scattering layers and to measure those deep chlorophyll maxima.
So there are other ways that amount of kind of in situ ground truthing can be reduced by fancy algorithms.
Absolutely, because you know one of the things that satellite can at least do is tell you where to look a little bit closer, so that you don't put your in situ monitoring stuff in the wrong place. And of course, I don't know much about modelling. To be honest, I've always worked with this sort of data, but I know that if you want to take it to the next step, that's where everything's going to go. The vertical stuff is really hard, but the in-situ stuff that CFAS are doing, we've got gliders, so we work quite closely with the universities. Anglia, they've got gliders out in the North Sea all the time, trying to understand the vertical water column, and trying to understand upwelling along the deep canyons. It's just not something that I can answer, because, again, this is where my data ends, on the surface. Yeah, but it's a really good question. The water column is more interesting. The vertical complexity is where it's at.
Has there been any developments in the way that they feed fish in aquaculture at the moment? So I remember reading somewhere else, I think it was a documentary actually, that it takes like 3 kilograms of anchovies to produce 1 kilogram of salmon.
Yeah.
So we'd be better off eating the anchovies in the first place.
Yeah.
So like what you came up with earlier and basically saying that we're now feeding more people from aquaculture than catching from the sea. Is that including the fish that we're catching?
Well, this is what's so fascinating, right? You talk about aquaculture, and it's the food that you produce to eat, and then it's the food that you produce to sell. And there is a big difference between the two, and this is only now sort of coming into my field of knowledge. But that's very compelling. And, you know, CFAS don't advocate aquaculture. What we're advocating is a healthier way of doing aquaculture. And one of the ways that you can reduce that footprint is going for shellfish and for algae. So algae is huge. Like, why aren't we growing more algae? We have waters that would do quite well with algae farming, apparently, and shellfish farming. So maybe not all of the UK is good for shellfish farming. We have some really sedimenty, muddy waters. That's not necessarily ideal. But shellfish farming has very low impact, and it does really well. You're more vulnerable to harmful algal blooms, but perhaps if we can start to get a handle of how those are forming and when they're developing and get an early warning system. The other thing is that as temperatures change, we're going to get more and more vulnerable to things like Vibrio, and shellfish get herpes, and it's bad. But so CFAS are looking at breeding a more resistant strain so that they don't automatically die from the herpes virus. They survive, and then they shed it, and it's fine. But all of these things are quite complex, and we're not just talking about aquaculture for a growing population. We're talking about aquaculture for a growing population in a warming world. So there's a lot of pressures. And I don't know about the feed thing, but I know CFAS are really interested in advocating for low-impact types of aquaculture. So algae culture and shellfish are the way we'd like to see it go. But we're not advocating for it, we would just like to see it done more responsibly.
I'm going to ask if, do anchovies get lice? Cut down my salt and
I don't actually know. I only just found out that mackerel don't have swim bladders, and that blew my mind for like a week.
Any more for any more? Go on then, Bruce.
Kate's upload is very inspirational in terms of the use of our observation. Difficult question, but if you had a magic wand, what three things would you either see are about to happen or would like to happen to make this technology more useful in general?
Okay, if I had a magic wand that gave me a wish that's not really possible, it would be vertical complexity from the water column, from a satellite. The second thing is I would really like European Space Agency to launch more satellites straight away so that I can get more than daily imagery. The radar satellites at the moment, there's two of them, there's going to be four eventually, but they're only giving us data every few days. I would like to see more coverage, especially trying to monitor these vulnerable areas. I would like to have, I would like people to know that I can see you at any time. You know, like, I've got you. I would like the spatial resolution to improve, which makes me sound really greedy because, again, I never thought I would work with this kind of resolution in my lifetime. So, I have lots of wishes, lots, but one of them would be spatial and temporal resolution to improve and vertical. Okay.
I'm just wondering, how much better is the Airbus commercial vessel than the basic
game? Oh, it's extraordinary. Like, you can get really, really ultra-high resolution imagery. So, the C-Mammal, someone from the C-Mammal Research Unit was interested in looking at the Pitcairns, which is this tiny island, and they wanted to map it, and they were like, how much is it going to cost to get a single image at high enough resolution for us to map it, as opposed to sending three people there for a month? And it was cheaper to send three people there for a month than to get that, like, almost 3 meter resolution imagery of the whole island. When that becomes cheaper, you know, then things will, that will be a real big step change. So can I add that to my list? Cheap commercial data, that would be too.
Sounds good.
We all done the, we are heading into drinks territory, so maybe we should leave further questions and thoughts for drinks. So just to say thank you all for coming, bumper turnout. Hutton will be back next week, I think. Hutton next week, and we're back on the 1st of December with Ed Parsons, Mr. Google himself. So look forward to all those. So thank you indeed for coming, and it just remains to say thanks once again very much to Ron for a very interesting talk. Thank you.